Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Most of us take access to water for granted, whether it comes from a faucet, hose, or plastic bottle, it's always there. The supply of fresh water seems endless, however, it is a limited, diminishing resource. That seems counterintuitive when we look at the Great Lakes, the great rivers that flank our region, or have ever sought cover in a downpour. But last summer's drought showed otherwise. The resulting damage to crops was significant. It was difficult to transport what was harvested because of low river levels. A huge amount of the world's fresh water is used for agriculture. So finding a way to offset a dwindling water supply is becoming increasingly critical. Drought-tolerant plants would help. Later this week, the Donald Danforth Plant Science Center will host discussions on the subject, water availability and its impact on global agriculture. I'm Don Marsh. Our guests on today's program will participate. They are Dr. Roberto Lenton, Executive Director of the Robert B. Daugherty Water for Food Institute at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln. And with us in studio is Dr. Thomas Brutnell, director of the Enterprise Rent-A-Car Institute for Renewable Fuels at the Danforth Plants Science Center. Nice to have you both with us. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Don. Thanks for having us on.
Thank you.
Dr. Lenton, let me begin with you. I'd like to establish what we're going to be talking about today with a discussion at the outset on the global scarcity of fresh water. Give us your take on that.
Well, as the recent drought in the United States showed, there is a clear concern worldwide about availability of water. If you take it on aggregate, the amount of water that is available is certainly sufficient to meet our needs, but the availability of water is highly variable, both in time and space. And so some parts of the world are very, very dry, and other parts of the world have extreme rainfall at the other end of the spectrum, and we certainly see huge amounts of variability over time as well. So the question is there sufficient water in relation to our needs, and that is becoming the increasing concern.
What parts of the world have the most serious problem?
In absolute terms, the areas in North Africa and the Middle East are clearly areas where there is absolute water scarcity. But the key issue is where do we not have enough water in relation to needs, and that varies over time. And as we saw in the Midwest of the United States last year and continuing on, you can get very severe droughts in areas where water is an absolute necessity for agriculture, and that's when we have a concern, when water is needed and it's not available.
Professor Brutnell, it seems to me that when we talk about our drought, that this is really kind of a temporary thing. We think of it, yeah, we had a bad summer last year, but look, it's raining now, and it has been raining, and the water tables seem to be up. So, end of problem.
Yeah, no, unfortunately, it's never the end of the problem. So, as Roberto was just mentioning, it's this issue of timing. So, it may be raining today. It may be fine when you plant, but halfway through the season, when those plants are developing their flowers, if we have a drought, it'll affect the reproductive viability of those plants, so your yield will be low. So we don't need a drought all year long. It can be a 1 week or a 2 week severe drought with high temperatures, and that'll have an impact on agriculture. So it's that variability and trying to develop crop varieties to deal with that variation and the severity of the drought.
Do we need, for purposes of this discussion, to define drought?
I guess I'd pass that one off to Dr. Lenton.
Well, I would define drought again in relative terms. Drought is in relation to what the average would be in a particular location, but also in relation to needs. And so, last year, what we had in much of the United States is significant deficit with respect to average rainfall. What was interesting about last year's droughts is that in some parts of the drought-affected area, and including in Nebraska, even though there was a significant rainfall deficit, so there was a significant, let's say, climatological drought, the impacts on agriculture were not as great as would have been expected, say, 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. And that was largely because of irrigation on the one hand, but also more water-resistant practices, including drought-tolerant crops.
As droughts go, how did last year's stack up with those of previous times? I guess we all have this image still of the Dust Bowl of the 30s. Was that previously the worst drought, or have there been significant ones since then, too?
It was the worst in the last 50 years in this part of the world. What was serious about the Dust Bowl, of course, is that it was over a number of years and not just one year. And so last year's drought was the worst in 50 years. If it continues through this year and even next year, then, of course, it would be a major, major drought comparable to earlier ones.
What is the cause of what we're going through now? I mean, there's all this talk about global warming and climate change. Is this behind what we experienced last year? I'll put this to you, Dr. Brutnell.
Well, certainly climate change is a contributor to this. So global temperatures are increasing. The models are predicting more severe weather patterns. And this is consistent with many of those predictions. So, you know, I think that we really need to be planning for more severe weather. And from an agricultural or an engineering perspective, that's really where I sit and where my lab is focused. We need to figure out how plants deal with drought, so how they respond to the lack of water, and how to protect the plants from that those dry, severe periods and still be productive. So how do we get plants to come out of the drought? If there's no water at all, we're not going to harvest anything. You know, so if it's a very, very severe drought, it's going to be problematic. But often what happens is you'll have rain at certain times of the year. It'll be a wet spring or it'll be a wet midsummer. And it's trying to engineer plants that have increased plasticity so that they'll yield consistently and not suffer as much as they could if it's a severe drought.
Now, how far along are we in this research?
So it's still very early days. Last year was actually we were actually fortunate in many respects. Many of the big seed companies had field trials with some of their best drought-tolerant crops. Some were transgenic, some were non-transgenic. And those crops pretty much across the board performed better than the non-engineered or the non-drought-tolerant varieties. So, but it's first generation. So a lot of the candidate genes that people are putting into those plants now are not very sophisticated in the sense that we don't really know why they're being providing the drought tolerance. We just know that they are, and what we are moving towards is a better understanding of the molecular biology, of the genetics of plant response to drought, and then trying to engineer those plants to be smarter with less water.
With optimal results, what would the difference be with regard to what these water-tolerant or drought-resistant plants might need compared to what the plants that we're using primarily today would need?
Right. So there's really two components that we need to think of when we think about the physiological responses. It's what the roots do. So if you think of a plant as a giant straw, and the roots are what's sucking that water up, and the leaves are what is allowing that water out at the other end, it's both an uptake problem, so looking at how those roots find water and how they absorb water from the soil. And then it's also looking at photosynthesis. So photosynthesis is the mechanism that plants use to turn light energy and carbon dioxide into sugars. And that process requires water. A number of plants, though, have evolved mechanisms to prevent or reduce water loss. And so we have two different types of photosynthesis, C3 and C4. So the C4 plants are ones that actually perform better under relatively hot, dry conditions. So this is corn and sorghum, switchgrass, miscanthus, a lot of these bioenergy grasses, sugarcane, use C4 photosynthesis. There's another set of plants that use CAM, it's called, and they're even better at preventing water loss with photosynthesis. They partition their photosynthetic activities between the night and the day. So when they have to keep their stomates or their pores open, it happens at night. They lose less water. And then they do other reactions of photosynthesis during the day, and they're more efficient. So understanding how plants have evolved or adapted to these different environments is helping us to inform our engineering efforts.
Professor Lenton, what is your connection with this this kind of research?
The it's very much a part of a larger challenge, which is how do we grow more food with less water? If we looked down the road for the next 20 or 30 years, it's clear that we're going to have globally increased food demands, both because of growing populations and also because of improved diets, rising incomes leading to improved diets. And that's going to be a requirement that will have to be met in the face of decreasing water supplies. Decreasing water supplies as a result of more competition for water from other needs, but also because of what we were saying earlier, climate change, and as a result of that, more climate extremes, more floods, more droughts. So the challenge overall is how we're going to be able to grow more food with less water available for agriculture, and we're going to have to find lots of different ways of addressing that. And clearly one of the ways in which, and a very important way in which we can grow more food with less water, is with more drought-tolerant crops.
I meant to ask this question of you when the subject of climate change came up a couple of moments ago, but what sort of a reaction do you have when we hear from those folks who are climate change doubters?
Well, I just feel that the science doesn't support that degree of doubt, and I also feel that we have clear evidence that is happening now. The drought of last year, I think, is entirely consistent with what the models predict. So I think my answer to the naysayers is clearly the science just doesn't support that.
That's Professor Roberto Lenton. He directs the Daugherty Water for Food Institute at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He joins us by phone from the university. With me in studio is Dr. Thomas Brutnell, director of the Enterprise Rent-A-Car Institute for Renewable Fuels at the Danforth Plan Science Center. And we're talking about the diminishing supply of water and how important it is for agriculture, obviously, and some of the things that can be done to deal with this situation. Among the things they're doing is trying to come up with a drought-resistant plant complex, if you will, or technique that will take less water to grow what we need to have grown in this world of ours. I'd like to get you into the conversation at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. You can also reach us through Facebook. Back in just a moment to take your calls and more questions on this water issue. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. Our subject today is water conservation, the need, and some methods of conservation, including drought-resistant plants. My guest in studio is Dr. Thomas Brutnell, director of the Enterprise Rent-A-Car Institute for Renewable Fuels at the Danforth Plan Science Center. Joining us by phone is Professor Roberto Lenton. He directs the Daugherty Water for Food Institute at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln. We have some calls. People want to get into this conversation, so let's bring them in at the outset. Scott and Chesterfield, thanks for coming in. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. There was Science Daily published a poll a few years ago of active climatologists or climatologists active in research, and 97% of them said that that humans contribute to climate change, and that was a few years ago. So probably now, if they did the same poll, it would be 99%, and the only ones who would disagree would be the ones getting money from the petroleum industry.
All right. Do you have a question there as well, or you just want to stay with that comment?
Well, I'd like them to comment on what I just said.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I think Dr. Lenden made this point, and it's true. I mean, the vast majority of scientists are looking at the evidence, and the evidence supports climate change. And I think if you look at most of the – in fact, all of the major agricultural companies – their business models are taking drought as sort of the front and center issue. So there's huge amounts of investment going into developing drought-tolerant crops. So pretending like it's not a problem is actually not a very good business decision.
Do you want to respond to that at all, Professor?
I would endorse what my colleague just said, and I think the issue right now among scientists is how do we do? What do we do about it? Rather than is it real or is it not? The issue that scientists are debating is how can we mitigate climate change, and what steps can we take to adapt to climate change, including how do we manage droughts?
Regardless of what you feel about climate change or what anyone feels about climate change, the crisis is with us today, regardless of how it might have happened, and has to be dealt with. Correct?
Exactly.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones and bring in Carolyn calling from University City. Carolyn, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thanks for the program. I wanted to bring up the topic of fracking and water use and fracking. In particular, a proposal to use Missouri River water, I think specifically reservoir water, for the fracking industry in North Dakota and other areas, other sites in that general area, and what impact that might have on agriculture, involving the use of water itself, the loss of water, and then also the pollution of that water in case it is reused. And thank you.
All right. Who'd like to take that? Professor Lenden?
I can take a crack in a more generic way. I'm not familiar with the specific issue of the Missouri River, and I'm not a specialist in fracking, but I am certainly aware of the controversy over the issue. And the general point that I would make is that virtually every form of energy generation has water impacts. As a scientist, I think our responsibility is to really understand and quantify those impacts make sure that there is clear understanding of what those impacts might be. Clearly a lot of research is going into finding ways in which energy can be tapped with the minimum amount of impact on water and on the environment more generally. So in all these questions of energy generation and water impacts, the question is to figure out what those impacts are going to be and figure out ways in which we can meet our energy needs with the minimum amount of impact. But I do think we all have to understand that there is really no form of energy generation, whether it's renewable or non-renewable, that doesn't have some impact on water. And the question is, how do we know what it is, what those impacts are, and how do we minimize them, and how do we then make rational decisions on energy demand and supply?
What about the overall issue of water pollution or polluted water? How much of a contributor is it to the problem we're talking about?
If I can take a crack at that one, it's certainly very much a part of the issue, because when I was talking about earlier diminishing water supplies for agriculture, when I was saying diminishing water supplies, I wasn't simply meaning quantity, but also quality, so that in some cases the quality of water is not sufficient to meet what agricultural water needs. And that sometimes is a result of industrial pollution, but it's also sometimes a result of increased salinity and other impacts of that sort.
And I just, like, you know, if you look at what's happening in China now with all of their agricultural bottlenecks, it's largely driven through lack of water. You know, where it's wet is not where the crops are grown. You know, wheat is still a very important crop in China, and they've had a couple of droughts in recent years. And, you know, when you have 1.3 billion people who are hungry, you know, food security is a very important part of the government's policy. And they're really struggling with lack of clean water and water in the right place at the right time.
I'm not exactly clear on how much of a difference it would make if you came up with your perfect drought-tolerant plant.
So, well, you know, it's not going to triple yields overnight. These are going to be incremental changes in yield, but they're needed. So, you know, if you're planting a crop and you're expecting, you know, 150 bushels of corn this year, and you end up harvesting 100 bushels of corn, and you're a farmer, that's a significant loss of income. If you can add a gene to that crop that protects that yield and keeps it at 150 bushels per acre, then you may go from non-profitable to profitable. And, you know, it does make a difference on the price of the commodity as well. So if you look at corn prices now, they're near record highs. And, you know, a lot of that is driven by one bad summer in the Midwest.
We got a dose of that last year. I mean, we saw it. It's not only, and people should understand, it's not only the price of corn. It's things that are made with corn, and it's also the animals that are fed by corn. The prices for all of these things go up, and they go up significantly.
Right, and it has a real quick impact. So last year, farmers planted more corn on an acreage basis than ever before. So ranchers expanded the size of their herds. When the weather didn't cooperate, then they had to cull a lot of those herds because they knew they were not going to be able to afford to feed the cattle at the end of the season. That drove the prices of corn up. And, you know, in the States, we're largely buffered from the effects. Most of our food prices is still marketing. But in developing countries, when you're on $1 a day or $2 a day and the price of food doubles overnight, you feel it very quickly. And we saw this with the Arab Spring, with wheat prices contributing. And it makes for a very unstable political environment, and it's not a good thing.
But Professor Lenton, earlier in the program, you talked about some of the areas that are hardest hit. Is there a population figure that goes along with that, at how many people are at risk because of the water situation?
Well, certainly we, in terms of people who have trouble feeding themselves, food insecure people around the world, it's close to a billion people. So we certainly have a very large population worldwide that is food insecure. But I do think that the point that was made earlier by Dr. Brunell is really very important, because what happens in the United States is a drought in the United States, and it has an impact globally in terms of food prices. So it's not the people who are directly affected by the drought that one has to worry about. It's really the total population globally of people who might be food insecure. And as Dr. Brunell was saying, when you're talking about people that live on $1 a day or $2 a day, what happens when there's a drought in the United States, it really impacts them whether they're living in a village in sub-Saharan Africa or in India or in China.
I'm always troubled by the term food insecure. To me, it doesn't explain the problem properly. People are hungry. In some cases, people are starving, and that to me, food insecure kind of whitewashes that part of the problem. But that's my problem. Not
I would agree with what you said.
All right, well, thanks. Let's go back to the phones. Art joins us from St. Louis. Art, go ahead, please.
Yeah, Don, thanks for taking the call. Right now, we use 100 gallons of water per person per day in this here country. I think that's obscene. And, of course, we had Neil Berlog, who came along with his Green Revolution and countered what Paul Ehrlich was talking with respect to overpopulation. The thing of it is you got to look at your natural resources as capital, and I'm talking about your mountains and your aquifers. Your mountains with elevation and your aquifers are non-renewable. The elevation causes the winds and the rains to change. You take away the steel chainsaws from these people over in Indonesia that are demolishing these forests, and you go ahead and diminish the possibilities of having these type of drought conditions in Australia. Now, what I want to get around to is this wick effect that's in the Imperial and the San Joaquin Valley as far as the salt water encroaching into the rock strata, being updated through the porous sands, the type of soils which are helping to be generated by the addition of herbicides and pesticides and leaving the residues on the fields. They have to be cleansed with respect to the sprinkler systems that are coming out of the fresh waters of the aquifers that we're diminishing. And I guess all in all, I don't agree with this here finger in the dike effect with respect to the plant moisture uptake. I think we've got to go ahead and take away the ability to go ahead and change our environment by man-made greed. People want to
Art, okay.
live. They don't want to exist.
Art,
they don't even want to coexist until you change that culture.
Art, we've got the point. We've got the point. Let's leave a little time for people to respond to it. Would you like to do
so? I mean, you're right. All right, it's certainly drought-resistant crops. That's one piece of a much bigger problem. And you mentioned salinity, and you know, if you look at a lot of the estuaries, the regions along rivers that are feeding into the ocean, those used to be prime agricultural lands, and with rising sea level, as part of the predicted change with climate change, you're making a lot of those lands unproductive because they're becoming they're inundated with brackish water. So identifying plants or varieties of plants or through breeding efforts that can make those plants drought tolerant to salt as well as to drought is another solution. So, you know, I see this as a multi-tiered, multifaceted approach to solving these problems. Certainly, we don't want to keep deforesting. Brazil is making great strides in preserving rainforest lands. Their sugarcane production now is very balanced in terms of where the new plantations are going in. They're using less nitrogen, less water. So governments are getting it, and you know it's an important problem to tackle as many ways as we can. So it's not going to go away, and it's not going to be solved tomorrow. But if we start looking at water like we look at oil, we may move things faster.
Well, that brings – and I'll, Professor Linton, I'll give this to you. That brings to mind another idea. You know, we can pump oil in Canada and ship it by pipeline down to the Gulf of Mexico. At least that's what they're talking about doing. Why haven't we as a global community come up with an effective means of desalination and pump water from the oceans to the middle of this country or any other of the countries that we're talking about?
Well, desalination has really come down in price. So I think we have made significant progress in our ability to convert seawater to fresh water. I think what happens, though, is that despite this very significant decrease in price, it's still mostly relevant to coastal areas where you do have abundant seawater nearby. As soon as you're talking about larger distances, the costs of transporting water are humongous, the energy costs involved would be significant. So there's energy costs obviously involved in desalinating the water in the first place, but as soon as you're talking about transporting it over longer distances, those energy costs come into play. So I would think my quick answer to the question is it's a really viable solution in some coastal areas. You will see it quite widely used in some island states, but I don't think it's a global solution.
Apparently, they're doing some pretty impressive work in Israel, and this from what I understand, and I'm certainly no expert.
Right. In Israel and other parts of the Middle East.
Yeah. Have to take another break now. We'll do that. We're talking about water conservation, the need for it, and some methods of conservation. That would include drought-resistant plants. That's what we are talking about today. Number of people waiting in line to come into the conversation. Have to take that break. We'll do that and come back with your questions. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back as we continue our conversation on water conservation. With me to talk about this is Dr. Thomas Brotnell, Director of the Enterprise Rent-A-Car Institute for Renewable Fuels at the Danforth Plant Science Center. Professor Roberto Lenten is joining us from Lincoln, Nebraska. He directs the Daugherty Water for Food Institute at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln. By the way, the Danforth Plant Science Center Conversation Series presents water availability and its impact on global agriculture. This is going to be happening this Thursday at 6 p.m. at the Science Center on North Warson Road. Both of the gentlemen who are guests here this morning will be participating in that. Let's go right back to the phones. As I say, we have a number of people who want to get into it. Let's bring in Jay calling from Normandy. Go ahead, Jay. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you guys? Yeah, I wanted to find out, first of all, that my comment would be I agree with the guy that called about 97% of scientists and such. Obviously, global warming is occurring. But what can I do as a homeowner on my lawn? I know I don't want to put out a lot of water on the lawn. I've heard that buffalo grass would be a good non-water use type of grass. What do you guys think?
Let's take that, give you that one.
Okay,
Dr.
sure.
Brotnell.
So, yeah, so I mean, certainly using practices that are sort of environmentally friendly is a great start. You know, if you go out to Arizona or desert Southwest, you'll see that many front gardens are rocks and cacti, and so I think that is an important step. Buffalo grass should use water pretty effectively, pretty efficiently. Zoysia grass is another one that I think does really well under dry conditions. I'm not an expert in this area, but I certainly would agree with developing practices so that you're not using as much water on your lawn, and at the same time not putting as many pesticides and fertilizers down on your lawn as well.
But we can play a role as individuals, obviously.
Certainly.
In this. Are they called rain gardens? We've been hearing a lot of people are doing that now. They're taking rainwater, storing it, and using that in their gardens.
Right, exactly.
Any thoughts on what we can personally do, Professor Lenten?
I think the person Jay is on the right track, because if you compare the amount of water that your garden uses and you compare that with what you use inside the household, it's very, very significant. The amount of water that is used outside the household is significantly greater than what you would consume yourself in drinking or cooking or washing. So it's very important to be able to conserve as much as you can through rain gardens and so on.
I think it was Art who made the comment a little while ago that we use 100 gallons, each of us, 100 gallons of water a day. Does that sound like an accurate figure to either of you gentlemen, Professor?
It's roughly correct in the United States, but it varies considerably from location to location, and a lot of it has to do with with how much water is used to mow the lawn, to water the lawn.
Mm-hmm. And for swimming pools and such. Back to the phones. Barbara in University City, go ahead. It's your turn.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm Barb from University City, and I'm enjoying the conversation. I had two questions. One, it was my understanding, I'm a little confused because this program has been about world hunger and, you know, feeding our growing population. But it was my understanding that a large portion of the corn that's being grown is actually being grown for biofuels, which doesn't really feed people. And then my second question, which I don't understand the thinking behind this, is that I've been reading that actually the deforestation of the Amazon basin, say in Brazil, is continuing at a very concerning rate, and that a lot of that area that's being deforested is being planted in corn that I guess is going to be genetically engineered to be resistant to drought. And so the Amazon, which was a carbon sink, is now becoming a carbon source and is leading to climate change. So I just don't understand the thinking behind those two opposing policies.
Sure. Barbara, thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Yes, maybe I'll start with the biofuels and the corn. And certainly in this country, up to 40% of our corn crop is used for ethanol production. So, you know, we grow most of our corn. It's actually not for human consumption as it is for animal consumption. So the vast majority of our corn crop goes to feeding cattle or pigs or chickens and to ethanol production. And we need to, it's in the U.S. It's a commodity crop. In developing countries, that's not necessarily the case. Corn that's grown in many parts of Africa is grown for human consumption, and in China it's increasingly being grown for animal consumption as well, but not for biofuel. So it's a very difficult challenge. So it's going to be grown. It's going to be grown on large acreage. It's a commodity, and to make those varieties perform better with less water is important for keeping the commodity prices down. And the commodity price of corn drives the price of wheat, and it drives the price of rice and soybean and all of our food crops. So it's a challenge. We need, you know, and it's difficult to say it's good or bad right now to grow corn for bioenergy. There's benefits for having ethanol in our gasoline. That's better for the environment. But we do need to be transitioning to crops that are dedicated to biofuels. And certainly the research that we're conducting in my lab and in many labs is aimed at getting off corn as an energy source and using some of these water-tolerant or these water-resistant varieties of grasses that would be dedicated to ethanol production. And so that's the long-term goal, but we're not going to get there overnight, and we need to transition.
Professor Linton, do you want to weigh in on any of that?
I do. I think it's the question really illustrates how complex and interconnected these global challenges are, because clearly if we want to be serious about tackling climate change and mitigating climate change, we've got to look at renewable energy sources, and one of them is clearly biofuels. But at the same time, if we invest in biofuels, we recognize that biofuels compete with food crops for scarce water and land resources. And so we're in a bind in terms of finding solutions. Now, I think as Dr. Brutnell just emphasized, part of the solution needs to be to look for biofuels that don't compete for scarce land and water resources, so using algae and other things, other approaches that don't raise these issues of competition for scarce natural resources.
And, Doctor, you're doing a lot of research on algae over at the Science Center, are you not?
Yeah, that's correct. So at the Science Center, we have large groups that are dedicated to looking at algae in terms of their ability to produce biodiesel and oils. Again, the challenge with algae is water. And so it's, again, a problem that it's always going to confront us. So, and this is why, you know, my group actually doesn't see this as a food versus fuel issue. It's a food and fuel issue. If we make plants more tolerant to drought and to better handle the climate, we can engineer that into bioenergy, dedicated bioenergy grasses, things like miscanthus or switchgrass. We can move it into sugarcane, and that's where most of the ethanol is coming from, Brazil. But we can also put that into wheat, or we can put that into corn to help those crops produce better. So there will be competition of land and water, but there's competition for energy too. So we need to do it in a very smart way. I just want to touch on that point about the deforestation and the Amazon as well. So the Brazilian government is taking things more seriously with deforestation. So the currently, about 3% of their agricultural land is planted with sugarcane, which is providing them with about 25% of their liquid transportation sector. So you compare that to the U.S., you know, we've got 30% of our ag lands dedicated to crops. So it's a much smaller portion of their arable lands are dedicated to bioenergy, and that's because sugarcane is a very efficient crop at producing sugar, which is then used for ethanol. So deforestation is certainly a problem. It's certainly on the radar. And I think what we need to do is really develop these integrated approaches so it's not all or nothing.
You really connected a lot of dots here in your last comments. And you know whereof you speak with regard to Brazil. You were just down there, were you not?
Yeah, that's right. I spent a week in Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro and looking at the research that's going on down there, and also, you know, trying to see where our research fits in the global scheme of things. Again, it's as Dr. Lenton mentioned, everything's connected, and what we do or the a bad crop in the U.S. means high prices in Australia.
This Dr. Lenton, the coordination of information has to be extremely important. How effective is that worldwide in terms of people like yourselves keeping in touch with people elsewhere, making sure everybody knows what's going on and there's not a whole lot of duplication of effort?
I think that there's been a dramatic improvement in terms of communication globally on these on these issues in the last 15, 20 years with the advent of the internet. So I think we're in an absolutely different situation now with respect to where we were before, and we also have much better technologies that enable us to get information on water availability and water use and so on from remote sensing on to other forms of information technology. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
There's clearly we're in a better situation, and I personally spend a lot of time interacting with partners and scientists in different parts of the world. I think you still find, though, that some countries are very careful about water information because especially countries where that share common resources, and so there's a great deal of guarding of water data, which fortunately, I think, as time goes by and we get more information remotely, people are going to realize that that's not a very viable strategy.
I have an email here. I'm not sure I fully understand it. Perhaps you gentlemen will do more so than I. The writer says, we are going to get hungry if we don't stop listening to the big chemical companies on their, quote, marvelous improvements. What if we engineer a totality of drought-tolerant crops and have an Irish potato famine or something other than drought affects what they want everybody to plant? We need to keep diversity. Doctor, do you have a thought?
Sure. No, I mean, maintaining diversity and doing things sustainably, I think is going to be extremely important. And the big seed companies, they're aware of this as well, and many of them are moving more towards a sustainable view of agriculture where your inputs are less, you use less nitrogen, less phosphate. Both nitrogen and phosphate are expensive to put on the fields. Phosphate is actually pretty limiting. So, you know, we have a limited supply of phosphate that we can put on crops. Perennialism is part of that solution. So if you look at our dedicated bioenergy crops, we want to have those resistant to pests, resistant to pathogens. Some of it will come through natural the breeding process. Some of it will come through transgenics. We need as many approaches as we can take to develop crops that are going to be hardier and more resilient. And I think that's really the big challenge for the plant science community, is to not only understand how the plants do it, but to engineer them within that framework, within their own networks, to perform better with less resources.
Let's get another phone call in here as time will allow. Tony in Wildwood, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Good day. Two things. First, I'll note that alcohol is made by yeast. Yeast and algae are much more nutritious than corn. I noticed last summer after I sank my well an extra 100 feet that the local governments take no interest at all in drought. The developers, as an example, developers had automatic sprinklers going along the roadways for no other reason than advertising type stuff. And meanwhile, my aquifer was becoming useless. Okay, thank you.
All right. Well, that takes us back to individuals and governments.
Right, right. And it's treating water as a precious commodity. I think in the States we've had it pretty good, and anyone's been able to use water pretty much anytime they want. And when there's a crisis and it's a severe drought, then there's water restrictions, and then it rains and the problem goes away and everybody's back to their old habits. But I think we need to have a fundamentally different approach to water.
Professor Lenton, any thoughts from you along these lines?
Well, I do think that comment from the caller, Tony, was really important in terms of the role of local governments and local authorities in managing drought and managing water more generally. And here in Nebraska, I've been impressed since I arrived here with the role of the natural resource districts. They are local authorities elected by local communities, and they are organized on a watershed basis. So the whole of Nebraska has got 23 natural resource districts covering the entire state, and they play a hugely important role in terms of managing groundwater and ensuring that when there is a drought, that the water use is controlled.
Limited time left, and Dr. Brotnell, let me give this one to you. We probably should have started with this perhaps, but as we talk about hybrids and what the kind of work that you're doing, we're well aware that Monsanto is running into a little difficulty now with some of its hybrid products. Do you foresee any kind, as a matter of fact, there's a case before the Supreme Court now involving
right, right.
Do you foresee any problems along these lines with regard to the kinds of seeds that you'd be working on? We only have a minute left.
Sure. So, you know, genetically modified organisms, GMOs, are still controversial in many parts of the world, and really do affect the economies of engineering these plants. So it's extremely expensive to put a genetically modified organism to market. And effectively, what we've done is we've created monopolies where only companies like Monsanto or DuPont or Syngenta can afford to use genetic engineering to do this. Having said that, it really is the most precise way of getting a plant to do what you want to. There are many fewer changes induced by inserting a transgene into a plant. And so I think what really needs to happen is the science, the policy needs to catch up with the science.
Well, I wish I had asked that question earlier, because I think that we could certainly have spent a little more time on that. I want to thank you, Dr. Thomas Brutnell, director of the Enterprise Rent-A-Car Institute for Renewable Fuels at the Danforth Plant Science Center, for being with us. And Professor Lenton in the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, thank you so much for being with us. We'll look forward to seeing you all Thursday when the Science Center's Conversation Series presents water availability and its impact on global agriculture, 6 o'clock at the Science Center. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Thank you, Don.
Tomorrow in St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with political science professor Dave Robertson about his new book detailing the multiple compromises involved in framing the U.S. Constitution. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. This is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.